seven major miracles and seven major discourses in which we find John, the gospel account writer, revealing to us some important things about the nature of Christ and so on. And this morning we talked about the major discourse in John chapter 3 of being born of the water and of the Spirit. Being born again or being born twice was the main idea. And tonight we're going to be talking about his first public miracle. And that's important to us because a miracle is one of those things that we can't relate to very well nowadays. And Maddie's getting tired, if you can believe it. Baby needing sleep, who would have thunk? She had a good nap too. Bye, ladies. So, in John chapter 2, right after John chapter 1, obviously, we find that Jesus is going to perform a miracle. Again, we're not too familiar with that in our modern context. The days of the miraculous have ceased in a visible way, at least, because we don't have any apostles or those that the apostles have laid hands on, if you track that through the New Testament. And so we are looking into the scriptures for an idea of what to know about miracles, how to interpret them, what they meant, and so on in this first century context. And so as we leave our thoughts from this morning about the first major discourse, and then we go over to the first major miracle in John chapter 2, we find this in verse 1. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And so we find, Maddie trying to interrupt Dad again. We see here that there is a location, Cana of Galilee, a small little community, no doubt, in this region of Galilee where Mary was present. Verse 2, now both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. Now, from what we understand about the traditional Jewish wedding feast or festival of the first century around this time period, it would have been commonplace to invite the whole city, the whole town, to a wedding feast to enjoy the celebration of the union of two people. And so for Jesus and his mother and his friends and disciples to be invited, that would have been fairly common, we know, from ancient cultures. So in verse 3, we learn this. And when they ran out of wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, talking about Christ, they have no wine. Now we look at that from the perspective of knowing this text and what takes place beyond it, that she was kind of nudging her son, not just simply stating a fact, but saying, oh, they don't have any wine. I wonder what could be done about that son of God who I gave birth to. What do you think about this situation? And we know that's the case because verse 4, Jesus kind of talks to his mother in this kind of way. Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? Now, we mentioned the idea of respecting father and mother and honoring father and mother. And it's interesting to see the way that Jesus talks to his own mother. Although he is God in the flesh, he still talks in a very unique way to Mary a few times. So he goes, what does that have to do with me? My hour has not yet come. And that little statement, my hour has not yet come, is a very loaded statement. Sometimes we just kind of breeze past it. But I want to take a moment to look at three other passages in which that phrase is used and see what that little statement that he said seems to indicate to us. So hold your place here in John 2. But let's go over to the book of John chapter 7. John 7. And we'll look over in verse 28. This is kind of at the end of a context that has some loaded information, but we don't have time to go through all of them if we want to finish tonight. So we'll look in verse 28. And Jesus cried out as he taught in the temple. So he started speaking very loudly, saying, you both know me, and you know where I am from, and I have not come of myself, but he who sent me is true, of whom you do not know. But I know him and am from him, and he sent me. So he's getting to a point to where he's starting to get a bit vocal about where he came from. He wasn't just some good prophet. He was a son of God from the Father himself. And then verse 30, therefore, because of the statement, they sought to take him, but no one laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. So that little statement of his hour had not yet come is used in John chapter 2 of his own lips. And then we have it mentioned here that he wasn't taken by the Jews yet because it wasn't time for him to be taken by the Jews. It wasn't appropriate when it came to what his ministry had him do. So let's look over in the next chapter, John chapter 8. in verse 19. And they said to him, "Where is your father?" Same idea here. And Jesus answered, "You know neither me nor my father. If you had known me, you would have also known my father." And these words Jesus spoke in the treasury as he taught in the temple, and no one laid hands on him. And here's the reasoning: for his hour had not yet come. So again, similar context, similar statement, similar situation, and the same statement: his hour had not yet come. Let's fast forward to John chapter 13. And if we look in verse 1, we're getting kind of closer to when his hour would arrive. And we see this, John 13:1. "Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end." The context continues. But the statement changes from "his hour had not yet come" to now Jesus recognizing his hour was now here. And so when we look back into John chapter 2, and we see the statement from Jesus to his mother Mary saying, "What does that have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." We recognize that he's thinking, this is not the opportunity that we're waiting for me to begin my ministry. It's not yet time for me to give my life as a ransom for the world. The timing is not correct. However, we look in verse 5. "His mother said to the servants," talking about the servants that would have been present helping serve during the wedding feast or the festival, and she said, "Whatever he says to you, do it." It seems almost, and I'll say it that way, like she knew what he was capable of. And so when we say this is his first miracle, we say that because it's the first recorded miracle. We don't know for certain exactly what Jesus was able to perform and do before this time, if he did anything at all in a miraculous way, but it seems to imply from what Mary knew about her son that he was able to do some extraordinary things. And so he seemed to give an indication that he was going to use that ability to not just help the wedding, but also to help his disciples who were present. So let's continue reading. Verse 6. "Now there were set there 6 water pots of stone, according to the manner of the purification of Jews, containing about 20 or 30 gallons apiece." Now, some translations like the King James have the word firkin there. We don't often measure things in firkins anymore. I haven't pulled up a recipe recently and said, make sure you get a gallon or you get a firkin of lemon juice to make your lemonade. So the equivalent of that would have been 20 to 30 gallons approximately per water pot. So if you got 6 there, it's either 120 to 180 gallons of water. Why in the world would you need that much water? Well, it's stated here in this context, it was according to the manner of the purification of the Jews. Well, that's interesting because you'd think you need that much water just to have people have some water to drink. But this water was exclusively utilized for the idea of washing. So hold your place here. Let's look over in Mark chapter 7. Mark chapter 7. And we'll look in verse 1 to kind of get a first century context here of what's taking place. I know it's commonplace for us nowadays, before you eat a meal, if you come in from working in the garden or whatever, you're told to go wash your hands, right? It's pretty good advice. But it had a special little nuance here, religiously, if you were a Jew, to go wash your hands before you eat. So, Mark chapter 7 and verse 1. "Then the Pharisees and some of the scribes came together to him, having come from Jerusalem. Now when they saw some of his disciples eat bread with defiled," that is, with unwashed hands, "they found fault." Now one thing to keep in mind here, the washing of their hands before they were eating was not just a hygienic rule that they came up with, nor was it a part of the law of Moses. It was a long-standing tradition to kind of go above and beyond what the law required to ensure that they were ceremonially clean before they ate a meal. They would insist through tradition to make sure that they washed their hands before they did so. And so we look in verse 3. "For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands in a special way, holding the tradition of the elders." So it was a long-standing tradition. It was not a requirement from God, but they still respected it, and they would not eat unless they washed their hands. So if you're going to have a wedding feast, and you're going to invite a bunch of Jews, you're going to have to provide a bunch of water for them to wash their hands in a very special way to not upset their traditional view on what they were supposed to be doing. So we look in that context and we see just quite simply that Jesus did not enforce that tradition because it was not from God. And in not forcing his disciples to obey that traditional outcome, he got some flack, he got some friction from the Jews of the day, especially the Pharisees of the law, right? So when we jump back into our context of John chapter 2, seeing that there were 120, 180 gallons of water in these stone earthenware pots, that would not have been surprising if they were trying to keep the custom of inviting the whole town, a bunch of Jews, to a wedding feast, to a festival of sorts, to celebrate this marriage. They had to provide this water. So it makes sense for the context. In verse 7, "And Jesus said to them, fill the water pots with water. And they filled them up to the brim." Is it significant that they were filled to the brim? Apparently, because it's mentioned here in Scripture. God could have simply just not had John write down the fact that they were filled to the brim, but it kind of gives us a more visual reminder of what these would have looked like. Large earthenware containers, completely full of water. Obviously, they just put water in these water pots. Verse 8, "And he said to them, draw some out now and take it to the master of the feast." This was going to be unusual, because normally you don't just have a cup of water that you bring to the master of the feast, the one who's in charge of arranging the whole feast for the entire town. You just don't normally bring him a cup of water. But that's what they were asked to do. And they took it. "And when the master of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom." So the guy who's in charge of planning this whole event, the planner of all of this, calls the groom and says, look, we've got a problem here when it comes to what we normally do. He said, verse 10, "Every man at the beginning sets out the good wine, and when the guests have well drunk, then the inferior," or then the poor wine. "But you have kept the good wine until now." So through inference, we learn in verse 10, this was not the very beginning of the wedding feast. It was sometimes toward the end, because apparently they had already set out wine for everyone to drink. They already drunk the good stuff, if you will. And now here's even better wine saved in a reserve that came from Christ and this miracle being performed. Now let's pause here and make some statements. All right, there has been an elephant slowly inching into the room whenever we talk about John chapter 2. And I'm not going to spend the entirety of this sermon emphasizing a point that's not emphasized, but I would be remiss if I did not bring it up because some of us might be thinking about this. There is a Greek word that we translate wine. Oinos is the word. In some locations, it's simply talking about grape juice. In other locations, it's very clearly talking about what we would call alcoholic wine. And so the question really comes to the forefront, especially in our culture today, when we look at John chapter 2 and we see Jesus turning water into wine, we have some questions. And I'm not going to go too far into this. I'll simply say that my studied opinion on this particular topic has changed throughout my preaching career. I was of the opinion a while that this wine had to be grape juice. But the more I'm honest about the first century context, the more I'm honest about this entirety of this context in John chapter 2, the more that I learn, the more it points to the fact that this is not just simply grape juice. However, if there are people that feel this has to be grape juice, that's a particular opinion that you hold, that's a view that you want to instill, it doesn't take away from the context, in my opinion. I have no problem with that. But to be completely fair, there are some other interesting nuances here in this text that if it was just grape juice, it wouldn't quite fit the context. And to be completely honest, if you look at one area here, verse 10, for example, what quality of grape juice one consumes at a wedding feast in the first century with no refrigeration shouldn't matter at all if it's just grape juice. And so the question is posed to us then, at least mentally, to try and tackle Jesus, we know, was sinless. He did not commit sin. At the same time, he made 180 gallons worth of good wine for this group to enjoy at a wedding feast. How does that compute? And there are varying different thoughts about that, and that's not the emphasis in this text, mind you. This is not the whole point of this miracle, is to have us debate whether or not it was grape juice, whether or not it was wine, and especially not does this text authorize us to drink in a social way or even become drunk. And so that's not the emphasis, but it is glaringly there, especially in our culture today. Other cultures around the world, especially, for example, Europe, they have no problem with this kind of concept at all. But from our perspective, our cultural background, we need to have conversations, but very honest conversations about what's being taught here. And so this miracle being performed, water turning into wine, that's the emphasis, is there was a miracle that occurred, not the fact that there was wine present. And so we look at verse 11, we know the emphasis is that because here's the emphasis. This beginning of signs, we use that word miracle to define that a bit more clearly. This beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee, and here's the intent of why he did it. Not because his mama asked him to, which is a good reason to do anything, by the way, but not because of that. He manifested his glory. And here's the result. His disciples believed in him. So that's the result of why this miracle took place. Mary helped facilitate Jesus being able to manifest his glory, being from God, and also to instill in his followers there's something special and unique about Jesus from Galilee. Now, let's pause for a moment and look at a few other signs that were performed by Christ in a very brief way and see the result, all right? So let's look over in John chapter 4 and verse 53. John 4, 53. We're going to go into more detail about a few of these in the coming weeks, but I want to simply reference them and make note. So John 4, 53. So the Father knew that it was the same hour in which Jesus said to him, "Your son lives." And he himself believed, and his whole household. So miracle occurred in John 2. Resulted in the believing of the disciples. Miracle happened in John 4, resulted in the belief of the man who was a father, whose son was healed. And then verse 54, for example, this again is the second sign that Jesus did when he came out of Judah into Galilee. Let's jump forward to John chapter 6 now. John 6. We'll begin reading in verse 13. We're going to cover this again. Couple of weeks, but here's the Cliff Notes version. Therefore, they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with the fragments of 5 barley loaves which were left over by those who had eaten. And then those men, when they had seen the sign that Jesus did, said, "Truly, this is the prophet who is to come into the world." Miracle occurred. It resulted in the faith and belief of those that were present, right? We jump forward now into John chapter 9 and verse 16. John 9, 16. Therefore, some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God because he does not keep the Sabbath." Others said, "How can this man who is a sinner do such signs?" And there was a division among them. A miracle occurred. Some said this guy can't be from God because we don't want to accept that he's the Messiah, basically. Other groups said, "How can this guy be such a great sinner, though, if he can perform these kind of miracles? We're starting to believe he might be the Messiah, the Son of God." And then finally in John chapter 11 in verse 47. John 11, 47 and 48. And then the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered together at a council and said, "What shall we do? For this man works mighty signs." They were troubled because he was able to perform miracles through the power of God. And they called a special meeting to try and figure out what they were going to do about it. The correct answer would be they're going to believe he's the Messiah, but they said, no, we don't want to do that. How are we going to stop him from performing miracles? Well, good luck. Verse 48, if we leave him alone like this, everyone will believe in him, which was the intent of the miracles in the first place, right? And the Romans will come and take away both our place and nation. That's the root of their problem. They didn't want to lose their authority to one who had greater authority than them, the Messiah himself. And so we ask the question then, if that's what a miracle is for, that those who are present have more belief, more faith that he is who he says he is, was that the intent in John chapter 2 from turning water into wine? Absolutely. It fits the entirety of what a miracle was to do in the first century, cause belief on those that were present. Also, it manifested his glory. Interestingly enough, we jump back into the previous chapter, John chapter 1, and we learn about the Logos, the Logos, the Word that was there with God in the beginning. Well, if you fast forward through all of that to verse 14, John 1, 14, it says this, and the Word became flesh, took up a body, he dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. Well, how did people behold the glory of the Son? Well, we look back into our text. He manifested his glory. He made his glory clearly seen by doing things that are supernatural. So if you're ever wondering what it means that we beheld the glory of the Word in John 1:14, it means people understood there's something special about this guy named Jesus, right? And then we asked a big question, and this is one that I don't think we've gone to too often. There's three other passages that have an interesting connection to this specific miracle. And I want to reference them because sometimes we can get so distracted by the fact that there's wine mentioned here in this text, we miss the overarching point of why he did it in the first place. Let's go over to Isaiah 35. Now, remember that Isaiah was written 700 years before Christ was ever born. Christ was pre-incarnate. Before he took up the body, before he was known as Jesus, he was in the heavenly realm with the Father. We know that from later studies. So in Isaiah 35, Isaiah is given a picture of what this coming Messiah would do. And I think it's an interesting passage. Isaiah 35 and verse 1. The wilderness and the wasteland shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice, even with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, the excellence of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of the Lord. Again, manifesting his glory, right? Strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who are fearful-hearted, be strong and do not fear. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, with recompense of God. He will come and save you. Verse 5, then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. The lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the dumb will sing. For water shall burst forth in the wilderness, and streams in the desert. The parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land springs of water. In the habitation of jackals where each lay, there will be grass and reeds and rushes. A highway shall be there and a road, and it shall be called the highway of holiness. So we'll pause there. Isaiah is seeing a time of rejuvenation. In the middle of nowhere, in the wilderness, in the middle of, for example, Cana of Galilee, there is going to be something that springs forth life, joy, rejoicing from this particular location. Now, if that's not enough for you, let's go over to Joel chapter 3. Joel chapter 3. This is, again, a similar context. Joel is seeing into the future from his perspective. At a time of rejuvenation from the middle of nowhere. Joel 3 and verse 18. And it will come to pass in that day, talking about the day in the future that we're looking back on, the first century, that the mountains shall drip with new wine, and the hills shall flow with milk, and all the brooks of Judah shall be flooded with water. A fountain shall flow from the house of the Lord, and water from the valley of Acacias." And so Joel sees something kind of similar. He says, I'm looking out there at a land of desolation and ruin, and I'm seeing rejuvenation in the form of new wine, of milk, of water, of streams that bring forth life. There's something on the future that's right in his vision of rejuvenation and joy coming. And then finally, we look over in Amos chapter 9. Amos chapter 9. Took you a while to get to Joel, so I'll wait even longer for Amos. Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, right? All those. Okay. Amos 9:13. "Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, when the plowman shall overtake the reaper." Think about that for a moment. The plowman overtaking the reaper. The reaper, believe it or not, reaps. If you look at the result of a reaper, there's just desolation, emptiness, and dead stalks about to dry out. But the plowman brings new life into the soil by making new produce. "And the treader of grapes, him who sows seed." So the person who's taking the produce, taking the grapes, if you will, and making something of a beverage nature out of it, for lack of a better word, is more productive than the one who's planting those seeds. "The mountains shall drip with sweet wine, and the hills shall flow with it." If you go into the context, you'll learn that immediately it's talking about them coming back from captivity. But also there is the nuance there of the new kingdom being established, in which you have desolation, a dead spiritually land being brought back to life by the word of God himself. And so when we look at all of that and we jump back into John chapter 2, is it significant that Jesus' first recorded miracle was turning water, a common drink, into good, sweet wine? Yes, because it's a foretaste of what we experience when it comes to our own spiritual rejuvenation. We take that which is just plain, our old dead man of sin, and there's that new life in it from Christ himself. It's something better than it was before, to say the least. And so, was Jesus condoning being drunk in John 2? No. He was giving us a picture that he was the fulfillment of being the one to rejuvenate and bring joy into the life of everyone that believes in his name. That, I believe, is the point of John chapter 2. And so let's not water down, for lack of a better word, water down this text and just think it's talking about alcohol. It's not, folks. Don't miss the entire point of what this is. Jesus is proving that he's from the Father, and he made his glory manifest by doing something supernatural to prove to his disciples and to prove to us he is the one that can make change happen from even the most plain things. It's interesting then, this is the first recorded miracle. It's interesting that he fulfilled all of those prophecies about being the rejuvenator of this barren land. And so we'll end our discussion about John chapter 2, the first recorded miracle for us this evening. And we look forward to next week, Lord willing, when we have our second major discourse on Sunday morning and our second major miracle on Sunday night. The invitation now is extended to you to be introspective, to think about your own relationship with God. When you view Jesus, do you see him as someone who's just a good prophet, a good man, or do you see him as the fulfillment of God in the flesh, rejuvenating our spiritual lives with his blood that he shed for us? If anyone has a need to come forward for the invitation, something in your life is not right, and you want to make correction, please do so now as we stand and we sing.